The headlines: Iran's foreign minister reiterates the country's support for Palestinians. Iran strongly condemns comments by the top U.S. diplomat as Iranophobia. And the U.S. and some European countries are evacuating their citizens from Sudan. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister reiterates the Islamic Republic's support for Palestinian resistance and people in their fight to liberate the country from the Israeli occupation. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the secretary of the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement. The Iranian minister said Tehran will continue its support for Palestine until the formation of an independent all-Palestinian state in the historical land of Palestine, with Al-Quds as its capital. Amir Abdullahian stressed that the global solidarity with Palestinian nation during the month of Ramadan is regarded as a great asset for Palestine. For his part, the Palestinian official also said all factions and groups are united in their struggle to defend Al-Quds and the Palestinian cause. Tehran has reacted angrily at a recent anti-Iran comments by the top American diplomat, saying that Washington is once again fueling Iranophobia and division in the region. Foreign Ministry spokesman was referring to Antony Blinken, who accused Iran of destabilizing behavior and said the U.S. remains committed to disrupting Iran's military procurement activities. Nasser Kadhani called the U.S. State Secretary's remarks provocative, adding that their sole purpose is to create discord in the region in order to sell American weapons. He noted that Iran's military program is purely for defensive purposes. Kanani also underlined that Iran had always been in favor of a regional security dialogue that led to what he called the recent positive cooperation, including with Saudi Arabia. He said it is the wrong policies of the U.S. that have brought insecurity and wars to the region. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the Israeli regime is on the decline and is losing its deterrence power thanks to the resistance of Palestinian people. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the Israeli regime's decline began some years ago. He added that the decline has now accelerated, calling on the Islamic world to use this great opportunity. Ayatollah Khamenei also called on Islamic countries to support the Palestinian people, saying the issue of Palestine is one of the most fundamental issues in the Islamic world. The leader said that the issue of Palestine is a humanitarian issue as well, citing rallies held in non-Muslim countries last week to mark International Quds Day in support of Palestinians. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with ambassadors of Islamic countries to Tehran on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr. Earlier, he called on Muslims to maintain unity to foil different plots aimed at dividing them. The leader made these comments during an address after the Eid al-Fitr prayers in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He called on Iranian officials to cooperate and support each other to resolve problems the country is facing. The leader also called on Iranian people to stay united, saying the enemies are opposed to their unity. Ayatollah Khamenei also hailed mass rallies held last week by Iranians to mark International Quds Day. He said the rallies dealt a blow to the enemies. Earlier, we talked to the spokesperson for Masabadil movement, Khalid Barakat from Vancouver, and he told us about the ever-growing unity among Muslims around the world against the Israeli occupying regime.
I have been participating in the International Al-Quds Day almost for the past 30 years of my life, and I see how where we are today. You know, when the first call of you know, commemorating Al-Quds and you know, positioning Al-Quds in the heart of humanity, the Arab world, the Muslim world, when that call came out, only a few cities responded. And today, we see hundreds of cities and towns are participating in Al-Quds Day. This is very significant. When we look at the popular participation on this, you know, the Zionist movement and the Israeli, pro-Israel organizations, they keep referring to Al-Quds Day as an Iranian-manufactured day. But when you look at the participation of Al-Quds Day, we see leftists from all walks of life, political parties, progressives, Arab Palestinians. And so it is very clear how Israel is living in crisis. And I think Al-Quds Day is one of those phenomena that exposes these Israeli weaknesses.
Professor of Political Science Simcha Abusada told us how today the Israeli regime has to face resistance fighters from within and also the surrounding Muslim countries.
Israel is facing the resistance axis in many areas of the Middle East region, whether it's Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, who are supported by Iran in the Gaza Strip. Israel is also faced with Hezbollah in South Lebanon. Israel is also faced with Iran and Syria. And let me just add one more point that just 2 weeks ago, that rockets were fired against Israel from South Lebanon, from Gaza, and from Syria, and there were also attempts to fire rockets against Israel from the Sinai Peninsula, which is under the Egyptian control. And that is definitely the nightmare of Israel, to be under attack from different areas, from inside Palestine or from Lebanon or Syria or from Egypt. That is definitely a nightmare for Israel, and I don't think that Israel is prepared for that day. Israel has been dealing over the past 75 years to deal with one or two countries at the most, but to deal with resistance fighters like in Gaza or in the West Bank, or to deal with Hezbollah or also other countries like Iraq, like Iran and Syria, that is definitely a nightmare for Israel that Israel is not prepared for.
Syria has lambasted the U.S. for intensifying its looting of Syrian oil and other resources in the past weeks. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said the U.S. is playing the role of pirates and bandits. We discuss this in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Now welcome everyone to the news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Damascus says that the United States has intensified its plundering of Syrian oil in recent weeks. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said the American forces have been smuggling more shipments of Syrian crude through northern Iraq to Turkey in the past weeks. The ministry added the U.S. is playing a role of pirates and bandits, calling on Washington to compensate the Syrian people for the looting of the country's oil and other resources. It further noted the U.S. needs to stop supporting terrorist groups and immediately withdraw from Syrian territories. Damascus has accused Washington of illegally stationing hundreds of troops in Syria under the pretext of fighting remnants of the Daesh terrorist group. And now joining us for the program is Muhammad Ali from Damascus and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Ontario, Canada. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Muhammad, hope you're safe and doing well out there in Damascus. What can you tell us? This is a story that's been developing for quite some time. We heard Donald Trump, former U.S. president, blatantly say, we're going to take their oil. What can you tell us what the situation is like today and how it's impacting the Syrian economy?
Yes, he definitely said it. He said, we're keeping the oil. It's not a secret. It's not a surprise. Almost every week or two, we see tens of tankers loaded with stolen Syrian oil, transported and smuggled out of Syria illegally by the U.S. to Iraq. Just recently, the Syrian Foreign Ministry said that the U.S. forces of occupation continue to loot Syrian oil and the natural resources, smuggle them out via northern Iraq to Turkey. The Foreign Ministry said in a statement that such U.S. acts of theft contradict international humanitarian law, impoverish the Syrian people, and prolong their sufferings. In the statement, the Foreign Ministry said Syria condemns such acts, calls on the U.S. administration to stop them and also compensate the Syrian people. And finally, the statement concluded by saying that the Syrian Arab Republic demands the U.S. To stop its support to terrorism and separatist militias, referring, of course, to the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, and also called on the U.S. to directly withdraw from the areas it occupies in Syria.
Thank you, Mohammed. And Robert, welcome to the program here. Mr. Robert Fantina joining us from Ontario, Canada. Now, Robert, we know that there's been a serious economic contraction of the Syrian economy. There's been formed back the militancy since 2011 in the country. Daesh was operating along with dozens of other foreign-backed terrorist groups, I should add, on Syrian soil, a huge feat for the Syrian government to deal with both militarily and economically. And then by the U.S. adding this, you know, it's really a crime. I mean, remember, with respect to the sanctions against Iran, the former Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, called it economic terrorism. Is this nothing short of economic terrorism with the state of the situation that Syria is in today against the people of Syria?
It definitely is. It's economic terrorism. It's a violation of international law. The United States has no regard for human rights, for international law. They're illegally occupying this section of Syria, stealing Syria's natural resources. The Syrian government does not want them there. The U.S. government has no business being there except to disrupt and attempt to destroy the Syrian government. We have to remember that this is part of a policy that Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State under President Barack Obama, began when she said that the best thing the United States could do for Israel is destabilize Syria. The United States has done that and continues to do that despite the Syrian government's attempts and increasingly successful attempts to regain control of the country and to bring back some semblance of order. But the humanitarian catastrophe that the United States has caused there and continues to cause will only worsen with the theft of the oil. And this is a valuable natural resource to the Syrian people. And the United States is stealing about two-thirds of it on a regular basis. This is a crime. This is an international crime. And the world should be condemning the United States.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe, both of you. Mohammed Ali there joining us from Damascus, and Robert Fantina joining us from Ontario, Canada. And that brings us to the conclusion, every one of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
People have rallied for the 16th consecutive week in Tel Aviv to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial overhaul. The protesters held signs and chanted slogans against the far-right Israeli cabinet. They urged Netanyahu to scrap the legislation despite his decision to delay the process. In recent weeks, protesters have clashed with regime forces across the occupied territories. The demonstrations erupted in January after the cabinet announced its reforms to limit the Supreme Court's powers. Critics argue that the changes will foster corruption and bring about diplomatic isolation. Political commentator Firas al-Najim says the long-running protests in Israel show that the regime is facing a big leadership crisis.
Shows you that the Zionist regime is in a big crisis. And they also are in a crisis in finding the right leadership to lead this occupation, this corrupt regime. I mean, they voted get this cabinet inside, and now they're saying this doesn't represent them, now a big portion. So that means they're in a big crisis. They cannot find replacements, and they don't trust their leadership. And it's been going on for a very long time now. I mean, these protests that are inside occupied Palestine in Jerusalem and different areas. And there's a big clash between the people inside occupied Palestine, like the settlers and the Zionists, and their administration. And the stubbornness of this extremist regime is also growing, and he's not willing to compromise to kind of satisfy the people that are on the ground protesting.
In Mali, a bombing attack in the central town of Savali sent at least 10 civilians dead and scores of others wounded. In a statement, the government says about 20 buildings were also destroyed after terrorists detonated car bombs in the town's airport area. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack in Savar, which is home to a military base. But the statement says that nearly 90 terrorists were neutralized in several operations across the country. The attack came days after three people, including a government official, were killed in an ambush by the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists. Since 2012, the African nation has been gripped by an insurgency which has claimed thousands of military and civilian lives. Several countries, including the U.S., are evacuating their citizens and diplomatic staff from Sudan as deadly fighting between rival military factions in the African country enters a second week. The U.S. says it has evacuated around 100 embassy staff from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. France has also launched evacuation process from the crisis-hit nation. The Netherlands has joined the international effort to evacuate its citizens as well. Earlier, Saudi Arabia evacuated more than 150 people, including nationals from other countries. This after a three-day truce promising to mark the festival of Eid al-Fitr, but shattered as rival factions continued fighting. Clashes broke out in the capital and some other cities last week after a period of tensions over a planned integration of the paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces into Sudan's regular army. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Allen was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. and they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'll be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. Goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified, and the sound, like the loudspeaker on the system, ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition, and man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort
that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. They must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program in the hands of the CIA doctors. She was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating. Physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in the medical record that shows any kind of problem ever. Behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf, and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. Don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why in the middle of the Korean War would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that described essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hofmann worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود باعث تو لو أتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tabakkol. I am at your service to talk about another strategy that helps us enjoy a more appropriate life based on the concepts of the Quran and Islamic narrations. Today, I am going to talk about a topic that by itself is a basis for a set of detailed and interesting discussions. This is a fact that we can learn a lesson or take an advice from everything we see. This world was created by the all-wise Allah, which is full of wonders and beauties. If we pay attention to these wonders, we will realize how much God is kind. He is kind to us human and how powerful and wise He is. Through this, our knowledge about God increases and we know and understand Allah more. As a result, our love for Him increases, and when our love for Allah becomes more, we can rely on Him more and trust Him more. This is the advantage, and this in turn gives us more peace and hope in our life. Let's review this trajectory once again. Paying attention to God's creation in this world leads us to understand how powerful Allah is. We also realize how wise He is. When we get to know Allah's power and might and His wisdom, since He is Al-Hakim, and we understand that Allah has bestowed us these blessings that we can see in the world, and He has bestowed them to us out of His mercy, our love for Allah increases. We will understand how compassionate and affectionate He is. And beside it, when we know that God is merciful, powerful, all-wise, our trust in Him increases and we can rely on Him in difficulties. So that when life becomes rough and difficult for us, we know that God is still there. He can support us and can save us. As a result, we get away from depression and despair when facing troubles.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Today, as time permits, I would like to talk about one of the importance and of course somewhat unknown blessing, a kind of blessing that we mostly take it as granted. Amir al-Mu'mineen, peace be upon him, Imam Ali, in Nahj al-Balagha, points to one of these blessings and says, how wonderful is man that he can see with a piece of fat, talks with a piece of flesh, and hears with a bone. Imam Ali here makes a gentle reference to the greatness of human curation and the great planning of the creator of mankind. And the Imam basically points to the fact that one of the characteristics of the creation of God is that Allah can solve problem with small means, small materials, and can give us some important blessings by a bunch of materials that at the first glance seem unimportant, like a piece of flat that is instilled in our eyes, a flash or one or two or three pieces of bone. But if we ponder more, we realize how much wonders are created in them, in that piece of flesh, bone, and how much important they are for our living. As I recited in the mentioned narration from Imam Ali, The Imam talks about some ordinary and apparently simple materials that by the power of Allah was created in a way that without them, we indeed would face a serious problem in our life. Those blessings are, as the Imam says, two pieces of fat that are in our eye that let us see everything, a piece of flesh that is our tongue by which we can speak, and some pieces of bone in our ears that allow us to hear. Now just imagine how detailed and complicated these items are. They are so complex to the extent that the experts in medical sciences, biologist experts, have been working on the details of these items for centuries, and still what they don't know could be much more than what they know. When a person is born, he does not know anything. Pay attention to this subtle point. This is what Allah says in the Quran, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا. Allah made you out of the womb of your mothers while you did not know anything. At that time, we didn't have any knowledge. Then our knowledge is gained through seeing, hearing, and thinking. And by hearing, someone should be able to speak. Imam Ali in the mentioned narration almost mentioned these items. A piece of fatty-like tissue to see, a piece of flesh to speak, and a piece of bone to hear. If someone neither see, nor hear, nor speak, then we can see that his communication with the outside world is almost cut off. He could not gain required knowledge. As a result, most of the knowledge we have is due to a fat, a meat or flesh, and some pieces of bone. These items are the gate for gaining knowledge, improvement, advancement, understanding, and realizing the beauties of nature, understanding the wonders of Allah's creation, and much more. When we realize that Allah is that much powerful, we will become more prone to rely on Him. We will have more tendency to regard Allah as the best supporter because we see that He is so merciful. He is so affectionate that has equipped us with these features. These are just three or four items of our body that we must put them, that we must understand them and regard them as the blessing of Allah and put them next to hundreds and thousands of other items that are created in our body alongside with much more blessing outside of our body. Like the shining of the sun, the darkness of the night to sleep, different colors that exist in the world, accurate conversion of day to night and night to day. These blessings are so much that Allah says in the Quran, فَإِن تَعُدُّوا نِعْمَةَ اللَّهِ لَا تُحْصُوهَا. If you want to count God's blessing, it is beyond your power and capability. Our time is coming to an end, but there are some important points about the mentioned narration from Imam Ali, which God willing, if I get a fortune, I will talk more about them. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash. Share, he knows. Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.